Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you for your support during this fall membership pledge drive. With the November election less than a month away, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is in South Florida for a number of campaign events. He'll be speaking at the Little Haiti Cultural Center and then heading to Little Havana before an NBC town hall at the Perez Art Museum tonight. The former vice president's visit comes as President Trump remains hospitalized for COVID-19 at the Walter Reed Memorial Hospital. The coronavirus is expected to be a main piece of Biden's conversations with voters. Today's also the final day to register to vote in Florida to participate in the November election. We recently spoke with the Miami Herald's David Smiley.
Well, Joe Biden, at this point, with people voting in Florida, mail ballots are out. His campaign says he is trying to broaden his coalition. He's basically just trying to win over. He is still persuading voters, trying to win over largely Hispanic voters and Black voters in South Florida, which in a majority minority county make up the bulk of the voting base. And his campaign clearly is seeing what polls are suggesting, which is that he's doing well with Hispanic voters and Black voters in Miami-Dade County, which is Florida's most populous county. There are 1.5 million voters registered in Miami-Dade County. But he probably could be doing better. And so he is coming down today, I think, to show deference, to show these communities that he cares and is showing up to talk to them in person, as opposed to sending surrogates or spending a bunch of money on TV ads, all of which he's doing. But his campaign believes a personal appearance is necessary.
When Kamala Harris visited Doral last month, she got a lot of pushback for not visiting Little Haiti as part of the time here. How's the Biden campaign seeking to improve their standing in that community?
Well, one of Biden's visits today is to the city of Miami's Little Haiti Cultural Complex. And so I don't know much about the details yet at this point, but we do know he is meeting with Haitian Americans in Miami. Whether this was planned as a direct result of the criticism they received, I do not know that. But it certainly does seem to be something that the campaign chose to do in order to mollify those concerns.
You know, Biden's visit comes as the president remains hospitalized for the coronavirus and numerous members of his staff have tested positive. Former Vice President Biden has tested negative, but rapid tests aren't always accurate. What precautions is the campaign taking for his safety and also the safety of others?
Well, Joe Biden is now, his campaign is now releasing, or at least they say they will release all of the results of his testing. So that is one transparency measure that they are taking that is new. But they have consistently said that all of their campaign events are and will be socially distanced and conducted in accordance with local coronavirus restrictions. Harris's visit to Miami was pretty limited in terms of the press that they allowed to cover her visit. She really didn't come into close contact with much of anyone outside of a small group of people that met with her at Florida Memorial University. And for Joe Biden, it's much of the same. It's limiting the press. It sounds like they're not even going to credential reporters for the town hall in NBC tonight outside of the pool. That's the group of reporters that's following him around. So they're really limiting people who are coming into any kind of close proximity with him. And they're trying to organize very structured and restricted events so that he can go into neighborhoods, into communities, and campaign in person, but without having to have the risk of potentially coming into contact with a number of people with whom the campaign can't sort of regulate who's coming in and who's coming out.
So new polling data following last week's debate found that Biden's support among Hispanic voters continues to grow, especially Miami-Dade County. What are some of the takeaways from that poll?
Well, as you mentioned, with Hispanic voters, the Ben Dixon and Amandi International poll for the Miami Herald that we released today, really the big numbers are that he moved from being behind Trump with Hispanic voters by 1 point to being ahead by 9 points. And the real movement below that number is with Cuban Americans. Trump losing ground with Cuban Americans and Biden gaining ground. Now it's one poll. These are sub-samples, so it's a smaller sample size than what you would see in the larger poll, which gauged support in Miami-Dade County overall. So I would definitely caution people from making too much of it. There are, polls are subject to margins of error, but this survey does seem to suggest that the large amount of money that Biden and his allies are spending on TV in Spanish language, most importantly, are helping to boost his standing, and also, you know, raise the question as to whether the debate on Tuesday night, Trump testing positive for coronavirus, all of these things going on while this poll was in the field, might have pushed voters toward Biden or away from Trump.
So how important will it be for either candidate to win significant numbers in Florida's biggest counties in order to take the state in November?
Well, if you look at Miami-Dade County in 2016, Trump won Florida by about 112,000 votes, but he lost Miami-Dade County by almost 300,000. So if you want to look at it another way, basically Donald Trump won 66 of the state's counties by about 412,000 votes, right? So he put himself in a very big hole in Miami-Dade County that he was able to claw his way out of. I think there's reason to believe that Trump will not do as well in the other 66 this time around, but we should also expect him to do better in Miami-Dade County. So, you know, the most populous counties have the most votes to win, and you get your most bang for your buck, essentially, whether it's going to visit in person and getting earned media through newspapers and on TV and radio, or whether it's spending money on TV. And for Trump and for Biden, you know, if you have 5% undecided voters in Miami-Dade County, that's a pretty small number. But on the other hand, in a county of 1.5 million voters, you're still approaching a number that's going to be close to 100,000. So there's still, even if most people have made up their minds in these large counties, there's still a significant number of votes to be had. And we know Florida has a fairly long history at this point of elections being decided by pretty small margins.
So how much do we know Biden's campaign and even former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, how much they're spending in Florida?
Well, Mike Bloomberg has said he will spend $100 million in the state of Florida. And I think at this point we should take him at his word, because he has put out a number of press releases announcing his dedications from that pot of money. For Biden, I do not know the entire number, but I can say that just looking at TV spending, Politico has done a lot of good reporting on just how much money is being spent in Florida on TV this election cycle, and we've already shattered the record set in 2016. So the campaigns are easily going to spend more than $250 million in the state trying to win over voters or push their voters to the polls.
Today is the final day for voter registration in the state. Do we know if either party holds an advantage right now in registration?
Yeah, so Democrats continue to hold an advantage over Republicans. We don't know what the final number is going to be. Future voters still have a couple of hours to register. But we just heard the chairman of the Republican Party of Florida say that he has reason to believe the final advantage that Democrats hold over Republicans going into the election will be around 180,000, which might sound good, but Democrats had somewhere around 350,000 more voters than Republicans going into the 2016 election. And I think that's a huge red flag for Democrats. They are talking a lot about how many mail ballots are going out to Democrats this election. But if you have fewer voters in comparison to your opponent than you did 4 years ago when you lost, that's not a good sign. And Florida Republicans have consistently shown that they are better at turning out their voters in Florida than Democrats. So I think that's a big problem for Biden in Florida.
It is the last day to register to vote, but it's an easy process. Could you remind people of how to do it, please?
Yeah, you can go online. Go to your local county supervisor of elections office. You can go to their website, and there should be fairly simple directions online to help direct you. I know there are on the Miami-Dade County Supervisor of Elections website. You can call them. Hopefully, if you try to do it online, it should be fairly simple.
That was the Miami Herald's David Smiley. Stay tuned to All Things Considered as we give you updates on Joe Biden's visit to Miami today. Well, still to come, how is South Florida's hospitality industry making a comeback? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Bars and restaurants are catching a break with Governor Ron DeSantis' most recent order, allowing them to reopen with fewer restrictions. People in the industry who were laid off or lost their job when the shutdown happened are now looking forward to rejoining the workforce. The free Bacardi Teach program from FIU's Hospitality School is aiming to help these workers better their job prospects. We spoke with Brian Connors. He's an interim director at FIU's School of Hospitality and Tourism Management, and also Jonathan Mendez, a recent graduate from the school. Jonathan, I want to start with you. You were working as a bartender, I believe, when everything just started to shut down and stop. And I wanted you to take me back briefly and tell me a little bit about what happened. What was going on at the time?
I was working at the Fountain Blue as a bartender. And out of nowhere, I was working my shift at the bar. The manager, they just basically went to everyone and said, okay, we're going to close the restaurant. We don't know for how long it's going to happen. We need to go through everything. We need to lock this up. We need to get rid of all perishables, make sure everything is spotless, etc. It was a somber mood around. We actually had the president of the Fountain Blue, Phil Goldfarb, dining with his wife. And he was just kind of going around the restaurant. He knows everyone by name. And he was, saying bye to everyone. And he was definitely kind of sad to see, this beautiful big resort that we've spent, so much time and love into shutting abruptly like that. Definitely everyone was kind of in like a somber farewell type of mood.
Brian, how has FIU responded to the hardships? I mean, everything stopped and everybody's life was flipped upside down.
I still recall the day Dean Chang called me up and says, we have to do something to help. And this was probably in March 20th change in around there. And we started hashing together the ideas to launch Bacardi Teach as fast as we possibly can, as well as the dean, as well as Lee Schreiger from our South Beach Food and Wine Festival for our hospitality relief fund. To date, we have over 1,600 courses taken through Bacardi Teach, which is our online, on-demand learning platform for the spirits industry. And the best part about it, Luis, is we're just getting started. We have a ways to go, but to answer your question in the long way, we responded very quickly.
By the way, that the Bacardi Teach Spirits Education Program, is that free right now?
Absolutely. And as we continue to build it out, we're going to continue to offer it free, particularly for our hospitality family members, as we like to say, that people in our community that need help. These are the tools now that we're giving them. They can go on and earn spirits badges. So these are micro-credentialing. They're able to do that. If they take a series of them and they can pick and choose, which we call a la carte learning, they can pick and choose what they want to do. They can then get a certificate of completion. The best part about this is that certificate of completion as well as the badges are resumeable. So they're able to go and say, hey, you know what? I went and took these courses. I know more about these products. And our next level we're going into is also the art and science and mixology. So we're going to be doing the basic levels all the way up. And again, this will all be free for the community and particularly for the hospitality community as well. But we all offered everyone. Yeah.
Jonathan, so first of all, you graduated this summer, and I just want to say congratulations. What are you hearing from other people who graduated with you about what their prospects look like? What did they do? Did they move back home? Are they, jumping into other careers now? What's going on? What's happening?
Yes, definitely. There's been a little bit of everything, kind of dependent on what someone's situation is. I've seen a boost in entrepreneurship, I would say, which is something that makes me proud. But yeah, people are thinking about also switching industries. I've seen some people go into the construction industry straight from hospitality, which is not really something that you'd always see happen. And then, yeah, some people just kind of waiting until it gets back and expecting it to come back. Because like Brian said, I do think hospitality industry will come back very strong out of the gate.
Oh, all right. So that leads me into my next question. Brian, let me start with you. We spoke with urbanist and researcher Richard Florida. He published a series of reports for the Brookings Institute about how cities need to change because of COVID-19. This is what he said about the hospitality industry in South Florida.
Right now, Miami and South Florida, but all American communities, are failing to think strategically about economic recovery. Think about this. This is like a giant natural disaster, like a hurricane which has hit the entire country. And we not only need to plan about how to get back on our feet, but how to recover, and we failed to do that. And I think, you know, we can go into this in more depth if you want, but I think it means really repositioning our economy from a tourism and hospitality and real estate economy that's based on deal making to a real knowledge economy that's based on some stable economic sectors, startups, finance, headquarters, knowledge-based businesses.
He's not saying that we get rid of hospitality. And besides, this is South Florida. Lots of people are going to visit. Hospitality is a part of our industry. It's a part of our identity. What do you think about what he's saying, you know, for the future of South Florida? Can we remain this big hospitality center? Maybe we should look at other industries instead. What do you think about that?
I enjoy everyone's opinions, and I'll be very candid that I am so passionate about hospitality that hospitality will always win. If you even think of the name restaurant, a restaurant is to restore someone. We welcome someone with open arms. He's not right by thinking strategically. And as I said earlier, smart players in our segment will survive. But at the end of the day, hospitality is all about how we make someone feel. And we right now need to feel good. And to feel good, we want to come welcome people. You know, we're looking at these things and talking about these things at FIU Chaplain School on how is it going to impact economy? How are we looking at the new things? But at the end of the day, there is nothing better than genuine hospitality and coming in there and being restored, because that's what it's all about. So it's not going anywhere. It really is not going anywhere. And a great analogy that one of my good friends and colleagues, Professor Nathan Dodge, said yesterday, and I'm going to have to give him a little credit here. He says, you know, in the wine world, when a vine is under stress and it actually produces better grapes for better wine. And right now, our industry is under stress. And what we're going to produce at the end is actually going to be a better product, because we're going to learn from this and we're going to grow. So I'm seeing positive things in the future.
Jonathan, now I'm wondering for you, I mean, you started your own business, so you're an entrepreneur, but, you know, do you see your path going that way, or are you just waiting for, you know, the economy to get back up and going?
My business is called Luxury Over Everything Hospitality, and pretty much it's going to be a platform for me to do hospitality consulting to those businesses, like I mentioned, whether you're restaurant, bar, retail shop, a doctor's office, a tax agency, you know, go in there and say, what is it that you're doing great? What is it that we can elevate a little bit? And then I want to do pop-up dinners in the future, you know, just take over a venue maybe for a week, have a few nights of incredible music, art through food, beverage. Also want to do an advocacy and awareness platform through our media. Just spreading the word about nutrition and mental wellness.
No, it sounds like you got a plan. That's good. All right, Brian, I'm going to finish with you. The National Restaurant Association has said that the industry is on track to lose almost $250 billion in sales this year. I mean, that destroys most industries, probably. But look, you're optimistic. Jonathan's optimistic. But, you know, we're in the reopening now. Florida's reopened. There are restrictions, but everything's back up and running, supposedly. What do you think that recovery looks like? Is it 3 months, 6 months, 12 months? You know, when does life look normal again?
We are impacting millions upon millions of people, not just dollars, but people's lives, and not just in the restaurant segment, but also in the other. So think about that laundry service. Think about that cleaning service. Think about the beverage side, and the list can go on from there. We're talking now 15, 16 plus million people that are affected by what's going on. You know, I had the opportunity to ask a very similar question saying, you know, what does it look like in the future? And a lot of experts, including myself, agree that, you know, we're not going going to look the way we did 7 months ago for about another 2 years, because we got to get better at what we're doing. And I know it's a very sobering thing to say, 2 years, but we need to get better at what we're doing. This is going to make us better operators. We will come back from this. Let's not forget, you know, the importance of all these things we've been talking about in our conversation, that we need to also save restaurants, save hospitality, and it's going to take all of us to kind of be part of it. Up training, as I mentioned earlier, the more we can give back to people, we're going to try like heck to give back.
That was Brian Connors, Interim Director of the Bacardi Center of Excellence at FIU School of Hospitality. We also were joined by Jonathan Mendez, a recent graduate from the school who was working as a bartender before the pandemic shut down the bars. You can find more information about the school's free spirits education program, Bacardi Teach, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, schools in Miami-Dade are now open. When will students be able to get back to sports? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Students are back in classrooms in Miami-Dade County for the first time since mid-March. Superintendent Alberto Carvalho toured three schools this morning. He spoke during a press conference at a new elementary school in Doral. This is audio from NBC6.
Despite what I heard from some people, I can assure you of this, or you can call me a liar. Every PPE needed in schools, every supply that needed to be in schools was in schools. Every bit of it. Everything that we need is on site. We have literally millions of facial coverings, masks. We have gone above and beyond. We never promised face shields, but we have provided face shields. Hand disinfectants, plenty in every single classroom, every single school.
Miami-Dade teachers posted on social media this morning complaining that the online education portal was down, internet outages are a problem still, and they don't have enough PPE. We will continue to update you on today's reopening on All Things Considered this afternoon. Meanwhile, sports and after-school activities are expected to start soon, though the exact dates haven't been announced. We recently spoke with Stefan Cohn, he's the Assistant Superintendent of School Operations, about when sports will finally get started and how the district will try and keep players safe.
The FHAA decided that schools could opt in or opt out of the state championship series. So our district, being strong believers in choice and communities and principals to have autonomy, we put it out to a vote to all 40 of our high schools that participate in the Greater Miami Athletic Conference. And as a result of that vote, we came up with five schools that chose to opt in football, and 35 that opted out in football.
Now, we're just talking about football, or what other sports are going on right now?
Part of fall sports would be golf, swimming, girls volleyball, football, diving are all a part of the fall sports landscape.
How would you describe briefly the relationship between Miami-Dade schools and the FHSAA?
I believe that the relationship is one that it's fine now. Earlier in the course of the proceedings of reaching this point, they were a bit strained, just a bit, because we felt as though they were not taking into account that we were not at the same phase as the rest of the state, and therefore we could not compete in the same phase with the rest of the state. And therefore, there was a reconvening of their board, and then their board came up with this plan that we have now. So at this point, our relations with the FHAA are fine.
So obviously back then, as you were talking about, the Florida High School Athletic Association was trying to figure out how to get sports started, or, you know, what the new rules would be. And, you know, there was a point, if I recall, where, you know, folks in Miami felt kind of left out, or they felt as if it wasn't going to work the same. And maybe there were even questions of just leaving and not participating in state competition. Could that ever happen? Would it ever happen?
That is a possibility, and it's one that our board has requested that we explore the possibilities and what the benefits or ramifications would be around that. We have to give a report to the school board in October as a follow-up to what those specifics would be and our findings would be based on our research here in the Division of Athletics.
What does it mean for a school to win a state title? And I don't mean just bragging rights. I mean, what does it do for the school? What does it do for the district?
Number one, winning a state title, it's the apex of the particular sport that we're participating in. There is a strong sense of school pride. It is everything that our student athletes begin to work for at the start of any season that they're in. But it also provides a larger opportunity for our students to have exposure to college recruiters, which translates to scholarships in all sports. So winning a state title has many benefits that come with winning them. Number one being student athletes having an opportunity to further their education by receiving a scholarship because of the exposure of the additional games, of the additional media attention that comes with winning a state title in any sport.
Now, athletes have already started practicing and training, right?
No, they haven't. Athletes were permitted as of September 14th to start with conditioning. And conditioning, there is such thing as fall sports conditioning where athletes are getting in shape, getting their bodies prepared, going through training drills. But these drills do not allow for actual sport-specific drills to take place. For example, any sport-specific equipment is not permissible right now, but it is the conditioning portion, which is so important because once you begin to engage in sports full-fledged, you can risk a lot of soft tissue injuries if you're not in proper condition.
What about when the games start? Will fans be allowed? What's going to be the protocols in keeping people and players safe?
The attendance at games has not been completed as of yet. Like I said, we don't even have a start date as of yet for when we will kick off these actual sports. We're just in the conditioning phase now. We are working with the FHAA for guidelines. We're working with our own district athletic advisors, as well as our medical advisors through collaboration to see what is the best practice. As you do know, there's around the state and around the country, there are districts that are already competing. We are reaching out to those districts, looking at how they're doing it and examining maybe some of what their successes, as well some of their pitfalls may have been with allowing the parents and the students to attend games.
So to play sports, obviously, you have to have a physical, you have to take tests, you have to have permission forms. For this, is there going to be an extra waiver?
Yes, there is. There is a waiver that has been created by the district attorney's office. Every parent must sign that waiver acknowledging that they've read the waiver and they fully understand that if they have questions, they can call our office or they are call the district athletic director that's at that school or principal, and we give them further information. But yes, there is a waiver in place, and as you alluded to earlier, there's the physicals that must be done. There are the health screenings that also must be done to ensure the optimum safety when allowing students to participate.
Is there a protocol? I want to know what happens if a student gets really sick or gets one of their family members very ill. Is there any consideration of shutting everything down?
Of course, that would certainly have to be given a consideration. Like I said, we can take every measure that we can to ensure safety, and that is the reason why we have the health screening surveys each day, so that if a student becomes ill, we can track where who the student was with, when it happened. And student safety is paramount. And if that means that we would have to conclude everything in lieu of making sure that students are safe, that is certainly something we will do.
That was Stephen Cohn, Assistant Superintendent of School Operations at Miami-Dade Public Schools. If you're a parent or student, we'd like to hear from you. Share with us your experience waiting for sports and share with us your concerns about COVID. And that's Sundial for this Monday, October 5th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we'll continue to bring you some of our favorite conversations over the past couple of months as part of our fall membership campaign. We'll take you back to our discussion with Carl Joost about Exile at Home, a new project from the Miami Book Fair. A reminder, this month we're reading In the Land of Good Living from Kent Russell. Over the summer of 2016, Kent walked from the Panhandle down to Miami, retracing the steps of walking Lawton Chiles almost 50 years later. You can join the Sundial Book Club by going to Facebook and searching Sundial Book Club. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.